So, on New Year's Day, 1979, my family and I decamped from the great blue state of Washington to move to the reddest of red states, Louisiana. Red defined not only politically, but also by the CDC, by virtue of its high numbers of STDs. I had left Seattle, the mecca of STD research, but found myself in chlamydia nirvana. The Big Easy. The Big Easy, long known as the Crescent City in reference to the large bend of the Mississippi River that defines the city geographically, the appellation Big Easy gained greater usage following John Conaway's novel and the movie that followed the book. Generally, the term refers to our laid-back lifestyle, love of festivals, good food, and great music. As for the origin of the term, in the early 20th century, jazz musicians referred to a gig as an apple. And they referred to a plum engagement in New York City as the Big Apple. Over time, the term became used as a nickname for the city, New York. In New Orleans, there were many ways and many opportunities for musicians to make a living. So thus, playing off the term for New York, musicians begin to refer to our city as the Big Easy. So what are some of the lessons that I've learned over the last 30 years in this most historic and culturally vibrant city in the United States? The captions are for my children when we've moved. I promised them when we moved from Seattle to the Gulf Coast that we could go to the beach every weekend. I didn't know much about geography of the Great South at that time. Where's the beach? Well, kids, there is no beach. It's 2 hours away in Mississippi. New Orleans is surrounded by swamp. Dad, did you say that dead people live in those little houses? Yes, indeed, children, they do. The water table in New Orleans is right at the surface. It is below sea level, after all. If it rains heavily, anyone buried in the ground floats to the top. Wow, Dad, this looks like a fun street. Yes, it is, kids, but you can't go there for another 15 years. Dad, what's an impersonator? In the Big Easy, you learn that things are not always what they first appear to be. When Jane and I started going down to the quarter for Mardi Gras, I saw this lovely apparition walking down the street. It was only after walking past and taking this picture. that I realized the anatomy strongly suggested male gender. Your spouse starts dressing up strangely in the Big Easy, it turns out. Jane came back before Mardi Gras about 15 years ago and told me not to worry about getting a costume, that she had designed costumes for both of us. In the Big Easy, people tend to live out their fantasies through costuming. That's me in the dog suit. Collar, and she's got the leash. Everyone learns to have fun in New Orleans. This is me in my now famous yellow polyester suit. Only in New Orleans would you find the chief of infectious disease dressed up this way with his arm around the chairman of the department of OBGYN wearing a tutu and black angel wings. I need to thank a number of people for this great honor, the ASTDA Awards Committee. This was very unexpected on my part, and I'm humbled by receiving this award. There are a number of people, though, that I also have to thank, the first being Carl Johnson, my mentor at the Middle America Research Unit, who guided my early efforts in research with arboviruses. King Holmes, of course, my fellowship mentor at the University of Washington, who taught me how to think critically, covered my early papers with red ink, thus teaching me how to write scientifically, inspired me by his enthusiasm for STD research and has supported my career throughout. I also owe a debt to some who trained at the University of Washington and who became supportive colleagues, friends over the years, and these include the great Walter Stamm, Bob Jones, Bob Burnham, David Eschenbach, and then later Ned Hook followed us in our fellowship pathways, our Madam President of the ASTDA, Jeannie Marazzo, Julie Schachter, who taught me most of what I know about chlamydial infections, and Charlotte Gatos, who's been a wonderful consultant and colleague over the years. Then there's Hunter and Tom Quinn, good friends, colleagues, as well as traveling companions, and Hunter's wife, Patricia, and Tom with his wife. I didn't have a good picture of Jeannie, but she's even cuter and nicer than a koala bear. Then there are the fellows, Stephanie Taylor, who's runs our STD clinic now and has continued our clinical studies with chlamydial infections, Richard DiCarlo, assistant dean at the School of Medicine, who did the chancroid work with me, Leandro Mena, who did a lot of the work with me on mycoplasma genitalium and is now at Jackson, Mississippi at the University of Mississippi, Rebecca Lillis, who's now on the faculty and is working with me on the microbiome work, and then Patty Kissinger, who's not an infectious disease person, but someone we co-opted from HIV research and got her started doing the repeater study for chlamydia, and she's just taken the bit in her mouth and gone from there. I'm very proud of all these people. Then there's my family. We could never get where we are without our families. This is my son and granddog, Lucy, my daughter, Jennifer, and son-in-law, Jeff, and their lively brood. And then finally, there's Jane, my spouse of 42 years. expert in HIV clinical care, more so than I ever was, former board member of ASHA, and my greatest supporter, without whom I couldn't have accomplished anything. She even lets me off the leash sometimes when we go for a walk. So Hunter's already described many of the areas that I've been interested in my career. And trying to decide what to speak to you about today, I thought about chancroid, fascinating organism, but it completely prevented itself. It mysteriously disappeared for reasons that we don't understand. So there wouldn't be too much to tell this audience about with respect to prevention. M. genitalium, it's not entirely clear yet as to whether or not we need to mount a expensive prevention program for mycoplasma genitalium. We need more data, so there's not much that I could say there. And the genitourinary microbiome is totally fascinating, entirely new field. It's keeping my old brain alive these days. But again, it's not clear that there's any prevention efforts that need to be associated with this particular organism. So what I've decided to do is to go back to my career-long interest in chlamydia. And today what I'd like to do is share my views with you on the U.S. Chlamydia Prevention Program and offer some thoughts about what we might do in the future to better control this important sexually transmitted pathogen. So what I'll do today is review the principles of STI prevention, describe the status of the current screening and treatment programs in the U.S. I'm going to offer some thoughts on better approaches, and of course, no one can interrupt me while I'm up here, so then I'll get to tell you exactly what I'm thinking. briefly highlight the potential need for a chlamydia vaccine, and then emphasize the importance of better sexual health education to accomplish these goals. So this is the May and Anderson formula, which many of you are familiar with. RO equals beta CD, RO being the reproductive rate of an infection or the incidence of infection, and over time, changes in the prevalence of infection Beta represents the infectivity of the organism, C, the rate of partner change, and D, the duration of infectivity. So, using these principles then to design control approaches, we could decrease the rate of exposure by decreasing the rate of new sexual partner acquisition. And in fact, to some extent, that's occurred in the United States. These are data that go back to, in the yellow bar here, 1988. And you can see that in both women as well as in men, there have been steadily decreasing rates among adolescents for those who have ever had sexual intercourse. And these are data from the National Survey of Family Growth. And I think that there has been a significant effect of this fact, and we'll look at gonorrhea and chlamydia in the context of this. We could decrease infectivity by increasing condom use. There's not particularly good data on this particular issue. I think it's something that probably did happen beginning in the 1970s, and I'll point out how that probably has affected the epidemic curve for Neisseria gonorrhea in a few minutes. And then we could decrease the average duration of infectivity in the population through increased detection and treatment. And this is the primary approach that we take to controlling STDs in the United States today. Screening programs, identifying those that are infected, getting those individuals treated, pulling them out of the pool, which decreases in the population the duration of infection. So just looking then at the gonorrhea rates and seeing how we apply these principles then to this very well-known curve for prevalence of gonorrhea in the United States. So back here in World War II, as it always occurs with war, there is an increase in sex partner exchange and the rates went up. And then as the war ended, troops came home, we got down to the business of rebuilding our country. These rates leveled off for a long period of time, 15 years. Many of us who grew up in high school in those days think of this as being the golden years in the United States. Then what happened? Mid-1960s, the sexual revolution. I learned about the sexual revolution relatively late. Unfortunately, it passed me by. Or maybe fortunately is the better way of putting it. So then in the mid-1970s, the National Gonorrhea Control Program was launched, and this involved CDC funding culture capabilities in state health departments around the United States. So we started screening women in prenatal clinics, women in family planning clinics. All of our STD clinics were providing cultures. Tracing, there was partner tracing at that time for individuals who were in contact to persons who are proven to have gonorrhea, and with the institution of that program, the rates started to drop. Then there was all the publicity about herpes, and then following that shortly thereafter was HIV disease. And I think this probably had the greatest influence then on decreasing rates of sexual partners. So therefore, the exchange rate or number of partners contacted were decreasing during this period of time. But then, in the mid-1990s, rates leveled off. So things came down to an equilibrium at that point. So our gonorrhea screening program, the duration of infectivity in the population leveled off. Rates of partner exchange, possibly. Can't tell exactly what's going on, where the balance is, but it's clear that in the mid-1990s, the rates did not fall any further. Gradually following, actually, a little bit, but not much. Clear leveling off at that time. So with respect to chlamydia at that particular point, all we had for diagnosis was culture. That is in the mid-70s when we launched our control program for GC. Chlamydia is an obligate intracellular organism and thus requires cell cultures for growth in the laboratory. So these systems are complex and therefore expensive. So while there was a lot of research that was being carried out at that time, using culture in research laboratories, screening and control programs were just really not possible at that point. There was a breakthrough that occurred, though, in the 1980s, and that was the development of the first non-culture test for chlamydia, and that was the direct fluorescent microscopic assay using urethral and cervical secretions. This assay did not involve a cold chain. It was easy to transport to the laboratory. One merely made a smear on a slide, and that slide was transported to the laboratory where under a fluorescent microscope, then one would pick up the little dots here, which are the elementary bodies for chlamydia, thus making the diagnosis. So it was true, a specialized scope was needed, expert microscopist was needed, but transport was very easy. So central laboratories could fairly rapidly produce results for chlamydia infections. And it was on the basis of this test then that in Region 10, that is the Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Alaska, that the first infertility prevention pilot program, or the prevention pilot program, was initiated. And you can see here the rather striking results in 15 to 24-year-old women in family planning clinics over that period of time. 15% down in 1995 to 5.1%. So this was very exciting and resulted in funding of the IPP program, which many of you, if not all of you, I'm sure, are very much aware. It was authorized in 1992. It was a collaborative effort between CDC and the Office of Population Affairs. It funded lab testing for chlamydia and family planning STD clinics. Initially, it was with the DFA test, but about that time, another non-culture test became available, and that was a GenProbe direct gene probe assay. This could be semi-automated, was easy to do in state health department laboratories in large volumes. It was initially launched, as I pointed out, in Region 10, and then three other public health regions in 1993. The project went nationwide in 1995. In the late 90s, then, we had some new tools that came on board. The first was azithromycin, a 1 gram dose. The sense at that time was that there was a lot of non-compliance with doxycycline, and Ned Hook, in fact, showed that very well with a study using electric caps that demonstrated that only about half of the patients actually took their doxycycline. And so it was deemed that a single dose of an antibiotic that could be directly given, guaranteeing 100% compliance, would be a significant help in the eradication of chlamydia. And these are data from the study that Hunter alluded to earlier, looking at both men and women for chlamydial infections, showing that azithromycin and doxycycline both had microbiologic success rates of 95% or greater. And so in 1998, azithromycin was listed as one of the recommended treatments for chlamydial infections. The next breakthrough that occurred at that time was the advent of the nucleic acid amplification test for chlamydia and gonorrhea. These tests are based on enhancing the detection of target over a million fold by amplifying specific gene targets, greatly increased the sensitivity and had good specificity, and automated assay systems were available for high volume testing. These are data from a paper published by Julie Schachter in 2005. There were 9 centers involved in this study. Each of the 3 centers compared different versions of nucleic acid amplification test, TMA, PCR, or LCR, against culture. I don't want to focus on the numbers that's in this table, with the exception of those that are listed in the combined group. Sensitivity of 91%, quite excellent, but the real breakthrough was the fact that this study and others showed that these assays could be used to detect chlamydia in urine specimens. So for the first time, we could collect a specimen, take it to the laboratory. We could collect a specimen without doing a pelvic examination in a woman, without doing a urethral swab in a male. The assays work quite well with clinician-collected vaginal swabs. That's a C-vag column here. But again, the most exciting thing was that women could collect their own swabs and that they were equal to the clinician-collected swabs for the detection of chlamydia. So this was another specimen that we could collect in non-clinical settings for the detection of chlamydial infections. So that led to a significant expansion then beyond family planning clinics where women were getting pelvic exams and therefore endocervical specimens were available, and STD clinics where urethral specimens were being collected, to corrections facilities. This built up over time. At the last reporting, I think data from 2010, 37 states participating, 60,000 women screened, 130,000 men tested annually. Job Corps, 110 sites nationwide, 15,000 women, 30,000 men tested annually. In addition, expansion of testing into general medicine clinics based on the HEDIS, or Healthcare Effectiveness Data and Information Set. This is a quality measure that's applied to all healthcare insurance companies, providers in the United States. Over 90% of these are subject to review for quality measures. And one of those measures then is testing young women, sexually active women, less than 25 years of age. These data from 2000 through 2008 show a gradual increase both in Medicaid clinics as well as commercial clinics. So this is very encouraging. Data showed in one of the presentations yesterday for the last couple of years shows that this trend continues. So we have our family IPP program and STD clinics, family planning, and then we've got these new venues that we've incorporated into the IPP program over the last 10 years or so. Where are we? Well, these are the data from that the CDC traditionally has shown, and I chose to go back a few years because more lately they've truncated these graphs that they show in the interest of brevity. But what you can see in the upper right-hand corner is region 10 right here. And you'll remember the slide earlier showing that marked decrease down to 5.1, and then continuing on in this particular area, perhaps going up a little bit. But the main point of this slide is that in all the other regions, beginning in 93 and 95, that it's basically flat. This was confirmed recently by Catherine Satterwhite in this paper. It was published in STD. Adjusting for test type, patient age, and race. And basically the conclusion of this study was that in the IPP program, family planning data, the prevalence rates have been flat. Now perhaps the IPP program data is, even with the adjustments, there's a little bit of uncertainty because it's not population-based. So these are data from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, looking at chlamydia prevalence in a representative sample of the U.S. population. And I think most of you are aware of what this is about, but basically it's a well-chosen representative sample of the U.S. population. Many issues, health issues of our, many health issues are looked at in order to see trends with respect to the health of the nation. And about 10 or 15 years ago, urine specimens were added for detection of chlamydia. So you can see over two-year rolling intervals that in white women, the rate of chlamydia infection has gone down significantly. And that's also true in Hispanic women, but not true in the group at greatest risk, and that is African-American women. So the health disparity with respect to chlamydial infections appears to be growing. Overall, then, if one looks at the rates in the female population, young female population in general, there's a slight decrease, but not a major decrease. So this is a projection that I put together then to sort of look at the issue and think about the issue of where we are right now and where we're headed. A steep part of the curve is based on the Region 6 data, but then coming down and then leveling off right around the mid-1990s. And so this curve is reminiscent of what we have seen with Neisseria gonorrhea, actually, because it was the last of the steep decline for Neisseria gonorrhea was from 1985 and through 1995. I think, actually, if we had had data from the other regions in the United States with respect to chlamydia, I think we would have seen a significant decrease in those states, probably not as high as in Region 10, where they had instituted the IPP program. But still, I think there would have been a significant decrease, because I can't think of any other reason why this leveling off would have occurred beginning in the 1990s, and we saw no change in those states at all with the introduction of the IPP program. So given where we are right now, if we don't change the way we do things, this is what I think we're looking forward to with respect to chlamydia rates in the United States. So what we need is new screening strategies and other strategies in order to bring this curve closer to zero. I think the school-based testing programs is the right approach here. And I'd like to just review with you a little bit of the data from New Orleans. This is a program that was started by Deborah Cohen and was picked up by Stephanie Taylor later. This was the first program for looking at CTGC screening in schools in the United States. It began in 1995, initially supported by an NIH grant and then by the State Health Department. Over a 10-year period, 25,000 students were tested. 7,300 were tested more than once, 2,640 infections were diagnosed, and 83% were treated. Hurricane Katrina brought the program to a close in 2005. We have attempted to revive it, but we just haven't been able to find the funding to do that. So what did we learn here? Well, these are data from three schools that were tested consecutively over the time intervals that shown on the slide. The blue bars represent girls, and the green bars represent boys. So what you can see here is that the rate over this three-year period of time in these three schools significantly decreased in boys. They went down initially in females, but then came back up, and the difference at the end, comparing the beginning and the end of the program, was not statistically significant. This was not a secular change in the community, as shown in the control schools. These are five schools that were tested about the end of this program, and you can see that the rate in girls and the rate in boys was about exactly the same as in the three schools when we initially started the program. So a slight decrease in females then, and a significant decrease in boys. So how can we explain this? Well, maybe if we look at the data a little bit more in detail in terms of, seem to have locked up here. Oops, there we go. Yes, okay, so these are data in the New Orleans High School is looking at the age distribution of chlamydial infections, and you can see the blue line, which represents girls, and girls throughout the time interval have higher rates of infection than boys do. The rates leveled off at 14%, in fact, in 16 to 17-year-old girls. Infection rates in boys lag behind, but they gradually begin to catch up, and it looks like the curves are beginning to cross over at age 18 and 19. These data were repeated, actually, in the Philadelphia high school testing program in a paper published just in 2006. And again, in pink, you can see the girls with significantly higher rates, boys catching up, and then at 19 and 20, crossing over. To project these data further, we'll go back to 1977 and Jeannie Morazzo's paper, Community Survey for Chlamydial Infections in Seattle. And indeed, you can see this curve crossing over so that the peak rates are higher in the older boys. So therefore, what I think is likely to be happening is since it's known that women tend to choose on the average partners that are 2 to 3 years older than they are, that this pool of older boys is actually reinfecting the younger high school girls. And that would, I think, provide a reasonable explanation as to why it's been so difficult or why it was difficult in this program to show a substantial or significant decrease in rates in girls, whereas while the program was going on, the rates in younger boys were steadily decreasing. So that suggests then that there is this a target for our intervention efforts need to focus on this 20 to 24 year old or 19 to 24 year old age group. And is that feasible? These are data from the Male Chlamydia Screening Project. It was carried out in 1999 to 2003 in Baltimore, Denver, San Francisco, and Seattle. over 23,000 men were tested. 90% of these were asymptomatic. Most of them were actually detected in adult and juvenile detention programs. Only about 10% were picked up outside or through street outreach, as they called it. You can see here that the peak prevalence rate of infection, again, is in this 20 to 24-year-old age group. So the big issue, one big issue for us, is to figure out how to get to this particular demographic. How do we get to these boys? Tom Gift, in a recently published paper, showed that in a cost-effective analysis that screening and treating men in a high-risk environment was more cost-effective than expanding current screening women from a general population. But high-risk environment is the key issue. These are data from the Philadelphia program in which they geographically defined areas at high risk. And that was just based on the IPP program, reporting cases from family planning clinics as well as STD clinics. So a high-risk area or zip code was defined as being greater than 3,800 reported cases for 100,000. The medium-risk group was 1,500 to 3,800, and low was less than 1,500. And so what the bars show by color, yellow being high risk, blue medium risk, and blue low risk, is the rates of infection in the school kids in those districts. And not surprisingly, I guess, is that the highest rates in the high school kids were in areas that were defined as being at high risk. So the issue here would be that it would appear then that our resources need to be more efficiently focused on those areas at high risk. And so those areas at medium and high risk is probably where we should, or almost certainly, I think, where we should be putting our efforts. So a plan for community-based chlamydia screening and treatment. We need to focus our resources on high-risk neighborhoods. We need to have school programs where all of the parents and students are involved, and that's what the Philadelphia program, the New York program, and our program in New Orleans, we had teams that were devoted to contacting the parents, getting the consent form back, and getting all of the kids tested. They'd be taken out of class, and they'd all be tested at more or less the same time. Now, that's unfortunately relatively expensive, so school population-based if possible, but the alternative is free testing and treatment through school health clinics. So at least this is something that we could relatively easily do. We have to have parallel screening and treatment in community and adult juvenile correction facilities. And again, these should be targeted, I think, for the high-risk areas. I think this is a program where we need to be testing in the schools and at the same time in those communities. It's not going to work unless we can get to the males. One way of doing that is through the corrections facilities, but that's not enough. We've got to come up with some way to get to those boys that are outside the detention centers in order to get them tested as well. Very disappointing results with respect to the long-term Philadelphia school-based testing program are going to be reported tomorrow. I was greatly disappointed when I looked through the abstract book and I saw this paper, and I read the abstract book thinking that indeed it was going to show a significant decrease over time, and unfortunately it did not. But I would suggest that those data need to be looked at pretty carefully. We need to see what kind of coverage we were getting in the 19 to 24-year-old demographic there. I know that in Philadelphia they're testing in their corrections facilities. At least I hope they're still collecting there. And so we need to figure out how we're going to do this. And I think one of the issues here is one of the approaches that we need to take is through the new focus on sexual health. I think sexual health education is critical for the success of any program like this. For this to be successful, the kids and young adults need to take responsibility for their own health. They have to believe that getting tested for STD is an important part of their overall wellness agenda. Only with the appropriate sexual health knowledge and belief system in place will they be likely to use school health clinics appropriately for STD screening. So we can get around that if we go in and have a program where we go after all of them, but I don't think we're going to have the money to do that in the future. So at best, if we could set up programs in our schools and make sure that they have testing available, and then if we can get these kids to believe in it, then, and also believe in it to the extent that they still believe in it when they're a little older, then I think that's we have some chance of bringing chlamydia rates down in this country. So in addition to high school screening, there's also the possibility of home-collected specimens mailed into the laboratory. And this is Charlotte Gatos' program, I Want the Kit. Fascinating program that's been about 10 years in existence, or 8 years in existence. They've performed about 3,300 assays. Their prevalence rate of chlamydia is higher than in family planning clinics, and the users of the system are equally divided between blacks and whites. But the people that are using this program have already bought into the notion of sexual health, I think, to some degree, because they're using the program. If having a program like this, I think, Charlotte, you're testing 800, 900 a year. We should be testing tens of thousands a year is what we need to do if it's going to have any influence. This program is picking up those that have already bought into the notion of sexual health, if you will. I'd like to emphasize the problem, the scope of the problem with these data. CDC-funded study looking at the issue of the use of self-collected swabs versus clinic-collected swabs to improve rescreening of women who have had a chlamydial infection. It's really two studies. In one study was focused on STD population, and the other study on a family planning population. So in the STD population, nearly 27% of the girls who were randomized to receive a self-testing kit, self-collected vaginal swab kit in the mail, returned those kits and were tested, compared to 19% in the clinic group, and it was a significant difference. Better in family planning, 41% of the home-collected randomized girls were retested versus 21% of the clinic-collected, an even higher success rate. So the good news is that sending kits home to the to young women indeed is better than having them come back to the clinic. But the really bad news is, look at the STD clinic, 75% of the women did not take advantage of this program to retest themselves despite attempted reminders, telephone calls, and so on and so forth. So this is clear evidence that, to me, that we've got to greatly expand our sexual health education programs in this country in order to correct this sort of thing. We should have 75, 80% of young women offered an opportunity to retest for chlamydia, given the fact that they're at a 15% risk of reinfection, to be involved in the program. So with respect to sexual health, then, this is an integrated care delivery and prevention concept that recognizes sexual expression as normative and encompasses preventive and treatment services throughout the lifespan. I highly recommend this editorial or commentary by Andrea Schwarzendruber and John Zentelman, JAMA 2010. There will be a white paper coming out from the CDC that's going to detail a program for sexual health in general in the United States, and will contain details about how we should proceed with educational programs. The Get Yourself Tested program is an early step in this direction. It's a very interesting program which is focused on kids and uses electronic media and uses things like Facebook, which I don't use, so surely it's going to be attractive to them, and this is a great first step. Just before ending then today, I need to touch on one other caveat, though, so which may in a major way affect the best efforts to control chlamydia infections in the United States. And these are data from Bob Brunum, 2005, where they had an excellent chlamydia control program in place with case reporting and contact tracing and the use of azithromycin. And what they noticed in the mid-1990s was that their chlamydia rate started going up. The apparent explanation for this is shown in this slide. The blue bars represent the numbers of recurrent chlamydial infections in Vancouver. And beginning in 1996, they began to increase. The line graph represents the reinfection rates in a vast. They attributed a large percentage of their rising rates of chlamydial infections to these recurrent infections in this circumstance, in their jurisdiction where they had a very good chlamydia control program. So how do we bring the May and Anderson formula into this? Well, there's only way, and that's to decrease infectivity through vaccination. So it may well be that this is our fate, that we're going to have to wait for the development of chlamydia vaccines. Fortunately, there are several companies around the United States that are working on this issue. And so I think it's reasonable to believe that within 10 years or so, we will have a chlamydia vaccine in the United States. But it won't do us any good if we don't have a population that knows what sexually transmitted disease and chlamydia are all about, and we don't have a population that does not believe that they need to protect themselves from chlamydial infections. So in summary then, I think that with what we have right now and where our resources are, we need to take our resources. And I don't mean to gore any sacred cows, but screening that's being done by the IPP program, I think we need to think about whether some of those resources need to be redirected. And I would suggest that school-based screening is one way to do that, along with outreach to 20 to 19 to 20-year-old men in high-prevalence areas. And I think that's likely to be the only way, given our current approach, that we're going to have a chance of decreasing chlamydia prevalence in this country. We need to work to ensure that the Affordable Care Act funded health plans will include chlamydia screening in sexually active girls less than 25%. I know I learned yesterday that, in fact, the program will pay for it, no deductibles, no co-payments, so that's a good start. But we have to get these programs invested, involved. We have to make sure that they're going to be doing this. Ultimately, the success then of CT control programs, including vaccination, if and when it becomes available, will be dependent on much better sexual health education beginning at the middle school level, I think. So, with that then, final lesson learned. Work hard, but life is short. So as we say in the Big Easy, laissez le bon temps relayer. Well, Jeannie just told me that I got finished in good time and there would be time for questions. I was hoping that nobody would be able to take pot shots at me. But in fact, this is an important issue, and so if there are a few people that would like to ask questions or goad me, go ahead.
Dave, it's Patty Kissinger. Thank you so much for a fabulous talk, so funny, so great. And I just want to mention expedited partner treatment. Don't forget that as a has its role in chlamydia. You got me started in this business and on the EPT, so I hope you are invested in that. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Patty. Any other comments or questions or challenges? Can we do this? I think we can. Oh, there is. No, that's he wants to take a picture. Okay. All right.
Thank you so much. Thanks, David. That was great. With that, I just want to have one reminder, and then I'll call the meeting to an end. Please remember that tonight is the networking event. Lynn, it starts at what time, and does everybody know the arrangements? People have been asking me how they're going to get there, buses and all that. So there are buses. Where will the buses be and what time? Because I don't think people know. They'll start arriving at 5:30, so know that everybody is welcome and should be a really good party. Networking event. hope that everyone can make it. With that, I'd like to close the meeting and thank everybody for your enthusiastic participation and attention. Thanks.